switch on the mic? I do. It works. Great. Okay, then let's continue with IFRS 13 post-implementation review. And I will welcome Aida Batrianiak, or not? Yes, project manager. Welcome, Aida.
Thank you very much. Good morning, and thank you for the time today to discuss our Wizard project. And we have a whole team here with us. Ashley, who gets a space at the table. Mariella, Michael Stewart, Post Implementation Review Director, making sure we behave. And myself, Aida. So we are really, really interested in what you have to say about fair value measurements. We spent the last couple of months interviewing stakeholders to understand the impact IFRS 13 has had on them, but we haven't had much discussions with investors so far, apart from the meeting at Investor Breakfast earlier this week where Gaurav was present. So I'm really looking forward to this session. So just to help us go through discussion, we have a few slides. I think it's agenda paper 2. I'm not going to go through them all, but I'll just highlight a couple of points, provide some background before I ask you the questions. So on slide 4, we talk about post-implementation reviews and what they are, and you would recall from that we have, this is not something new, so the board has already done reviews of a couple of standards, and the post-implementation reviews are due process requirements of the board to assess the impact of any standard, any major standard which has been applied internationally, after it has been applied internationally for at least a couple of years, and IFRS 13 came into effect in 2013. So this is what triggered the work we are doing and the reason we are here today. And just a couple of words on what the review involves. And we are currently in the initial stage of the review, which is a so-called scoping exercise where we identify and initially assess if there are any significant matters to be examined as a part of reviews. Basically, if there are any problems with the standard that seem significant. And after this stage, the board considers whether a full formal consultation is required, and if decides that it is appropriate to do so, then a formal request for information is published, which the board then considers and publishes feedback statement where it outlines the feedback it has received and if there are any follow-on steps. And this is pretty much the process we followed for the previous two reviews of IFRS 8, segment reporting, and IFRS 3, business combination standards. But we are not taking it for granted. So we are really assessing hard and working hard at this stage to properly understand whether there really are any significant issues in relation to IFRS 13 that need to be examined, rather than just simply go through the notions of stages of the process. Because so far, really, the feedback on this standard has been, you know, quite positive from the discussions we have had so far, and we still have a number of meetings to go. With the biggest focus, if there is any problems, it really seems to be in the disclosures area, so this is where I will ask you to focus today as well. But before questions, I'm just going to spend another minute just to talk a little bit about the standard itself, IFRS 13. So if we go to slide 5, so IFRS 13 came about because it's not that we didn't, the IFRS didn't have fair value before IFRS 13. Fair value was used in several individual standards, but each standard set its own kind of requirements. How do you measure that fair value and what do you disclose? And the board recognized the need really to consolidate it. Also, there is one single source of measurement guidance for fair value measurement, and also the disclosures that are prepared for anything that is measured at fair value are consistent. And this was the reason that IFRS 13 came about. And this links into the scope of the standard. So what IFRS 13 does is tells us how to measure something at fair value and what to disclose in relation to that fair value measurement. It doesn't say what should be measured as fair value or when that fair value measurement should be done. So as such, this is something that is required in the visual standards of IFRS 9 tells us, you know, when to do cost, when to do fair value, similar to some other standards. And therefore, even though we hear comments about it, this is really not in the scope of the exercise we are doing here as a review of IFRS 13. But just to help us frame the discussion, we did prepare a slide, which is next slide 7, which outlines, just as a reminder, which individual standards either require or allow fair value measurement. And you will see there are several of them mentioned here, and also what I just like to draw your attention to is that we have standards where fair value measurement requirements in line with IFRS 13 have to be applied, but disclosures are not applicable. So you will see, for example, IFRS 3 business combinations, and I believe you already had some discussions about that in past, and similarly, for a pension plan assets measured in at fair value in line with IAS 19 and impaired assets that are measured fair value as cost to sell. Also, the disclosure requirements that are applied, there are requirements in the individual underlying standards, not IFRS 13. And really, I'm just saying disclosures, so I thought might as well have a slide which lists the IFRS 13 disclosure requirements, and this is the next slide, which is slide 8. And it is really disclosures we've been hearing a lot about in our outreach, and you will see that there are various ticks for different fair value measurements, and we have more ticks for L3 column, which is level 3 fair value measurements, which what it means are fair value measurements that use significant unobservable inputs. In other words, don't rely as much on market data, market inputs. And as you might expect, this is the area we are receiving most comments and where preparers tell us they have most difficulties and they find the requirements onerous and they find this producing these disclosures perhaps not as useful as intended. Just before I move on to the questions, we have a slide 9 which just reminds us that this is a converged standard with US GAAP, and because US GAAP had its equivalent of fair value measurement standard a little bit earlier than in IFRS, they've already completed their post-implementation review, and overall findings from their review were that there were really no significant issues with the standards. However, they also did find some questions around the disclosures, which are they are currently looking at as a part of their disclosure initiative project, but it is very much work in progress, so there is nothing definitive being changed in the US GAAP at the moment. So with that introduction, so I would like to move on to questions for you. So we have 3 questions for today, and the first one is really asking you about usefulness of fair value information. And in that, I would maybe like to highlight by, you know, rather than simply saying it is useful, maybe highlight the bits that you find particularly useful. Or conversely, if there is something that you don't use, either because information provided is perhaps boilerplate and not really useful, or because you simply think that information is not something you require. So please feel free to hypothesize why you think something is not useful. The second question is asking you about any adjustments you make in your analysis to fair value measurements, whether that be, you know, any kind really. And finally, we ask you about inconsistencies. So, I mean, if that is okay with you, we would like maybe tackle questions one by one and start by asking you the first question on the usefulness of do you have sufficient information about fair value, how useful are disclosures, and if there is anything specific not useful. Is there anything you wanted to add, Michael?
No.
Thanks.
Well, I can start. I came across this, and I think to start with, it's very useful, particularly or more or less when you have IFRS 9 or IF 39, which is still in place in Sweden. I came across a small investment bank in Sweden. They went bankrupt because they had a lot of derivatives based on some German index or something. And they revalued the options in line with level 3. But they just disclosed that we valued most of them in line with level 3. They didn't give us any information about the revaluation, the amount that actually was put into the income statement directly. So it lasted for at least 5 years, maybe longer, but at least for 5 years. And then when they tried in a stressed situation to sell the options, they went bankrupt. And they kind of had losses equal to the equity in that bank. And this is a big legal issue in Sweden, so it's going on in the courts, but one thing is clear that they were not, at least no one can say that they had to tell us what the amount of revaluation that they did was. And to me that is of course very strange if you use the level 3 valuation. Level 1 and 2 to me is very similar. It's some kind of market price that you assess, either directly or normally through a currency based on a derivative. But I think when it comes to level 3, that is the most useful information. And what I would like to see is at least mandatory information giving me the number that they have revalued the asset with. So if you revalue the asset from 100 to 200, I'm not only interested in the 200, because it's bundled together with everything else. I want to know the revaluation amount.
Yeah.
And if I can kind of go out and sketch something new, that would be to have all revaluations in line with level 3 presented in OCI. Mm-hmm. And when they are realized, they can go into the income statement.
Isn't it mandatory to disclose it? Well, there is a requirement in IFRS 13 that asks entities to provide a reconciliation, for example, of level 3 measurements. In that reconciliation, you should have to disclose separately gains and losses. And also, if those gains and losses are unrealized, you should separately disclose those. If those changes were due because of valuation changes, again, you should have explained those. If the changes were because of inputs having been changed or used differently or assumptions being changed again, so you should have explained those, because especially if those were significant. So I think we should have covered that instance in terms of requirements.
But maybe just to clarify, which years does this relate to this?
The year from 2005 to 2010. Okay.
So if we were...
So now they wouldn't have got away with it. Okay.
Hopefully.
So now I can sue. Okay, then my
final... We're not commenting on that.
My final request is to have it put, the level 3 valuations put through OCI so I can see them more clearly. Gives me a better signal. And then when they are realized, they will be recycled up to the profit.
If I can just... just to highlight one of the requirements, disclosure requirements, that's in IFRS 13, and I wonder whether it'll go some way towards what it is that you're looking for. But it says, disclose separately changes during the period attributable to total gains and losses for the period recognised in profit or loss, and the line items in profit loss for which those items are recognised, and total gains or losses for the period recognised in other comprehensive income, and the line items in OCI in which those gains and losses are recognised. Those are two separate items that IFRS 13 requires separate disclosure of. So it sounds like that would go a long way,
that
would it?
That would cover it.
Okay. Yeah.
And just to clarify, maybe interaction with IFRS 13, I understand that IFRS 13 in itself doesn't tell preparers what to put in profit and loss or OCI. So your example is IFRS 9 requirements that are applicable for other standards if you measure something else. But as Michael said, IFRS 13 tells you if you have something in OCI or profit or loss,
yeah,
what to disclose and how to disclose.
Ah, okay. But I want it disclosed.
Yeah.
the level 3 valuations, all of that disclosed in OCR. That is what I wish. Okay, I'm done. Now we have Osman and then Markan.
So just two comments, both related to fair value in the context of IAS 39 or IFRS 9 as it's coming. First one is that, you know, these financial assets, financial liabilities, if you look at the split between level 1, 2 and 3, level 2 is by far the biggest bucket and has been for a number of years, both on the asset and the liability side. And I just wonder whether there's whether there could be a more granularity of that level 2 bucket. Is there stuff in there that's towards the top end of almost getting into level 1 but it's not, and there's stuff that really should belong in level 3 but doesn't? So is there something to be done around having more, a level 2 A and B or something like that? Or the other aspect is just looking at the table on slide 8, which is very helpful, thinking about the disclosures that apply to level 3 but don't to level 2s. So things like the reconciliation view opening and closing balance, the sensitivity changes to unobservable inputs, reasonably possible changes in assumptions. I think that kind of analysis could be helpful for level 2 as well, just given the size of that category, I think is worth considering. But really for me, I think I just have some doubts about whether some of the stuff that's in level 2 should really be in level 3. So it's just such a large bucket.
So just to follow up on that point, have you noticed in practice inconsistencies in how people apply this division between level 2 and level 2, or just feel they're consistent but you somehow feel it's not quite right? Where they draw the line?
It's a view that it's not quite right in some cases, but it's really hard to tell because the size, purely based on the size of the bucket, and just anecdotal conversations with some issuers kind of gives you a view that they'll always talk about the other issuers and what they might be doing, and so you get a view of what might be going on. The other aspect I want to pick up on, and I'm not sure it's an ISB problem, is just with regard to the fair value disclosures for the amortized cost assets, again, on the IAS 39 perspective. One is in terms of the reliability or the quality of that information given its disclosure only, but you know, that's perhaps less of an issue. The other aspect I think maybe worth thinking about is the granularity of that information. So you know, for those loan portfolios that are amortized cost, could we think about suggesting or recommending greater granularity in the fair value disclosures along the lines of what they do for the amortized cost disclosures? I think that would be quite helpful.
So what can you give us an example?
So if you have an amortized cost loan portfolio, quite often in the disclosure that the issuer or the preparer will disaggregate that by geography, by vintage and so on. And that's really quite helpful to understand the quality of the portfolio.
And you want fair value by the same?
Perhaps something along the lines of not just one number of fair values, a bit more broken down of that portfolio.
I mean, these two points you pick up on are really something we've been discussing a lot. Well, especially the first one on level 2 versus level 3. And just sharing, like in some of the other industries, there is much more in level 3 than in the financial services. So for example, we found in properties pretty much everything is level 3 measurement, and it doesn't seem to be considered an issue in that industry. But when speaking to people in banking industry, my impression, and please, they seem to think that level 3 is a bad business because, you know, they get penalized so much by the regulators for it, and it's not suggesting that they are somehow misusing the requirements. They simply say we avoid those instruments that would be measured at level 3, or at least some of them do, because of the consequences it carries. But I'm just interested if anybody else around the table has views on level 2 versus level 3, and what are your observations in practice, and how, you know, what do you use of that information?
It's that on the perceived quality of the underlying instruments themselves, not just on the disclosures.
And if you have, take that up in your answer, okay? So let's give the word to, no, actually Martin, and then Sue.
Yeah, I look at page 9 of the presentation, I see that the feedback was that some stakeholders questioned the adequacy and completeness of these disclosures, which means that there was room for improvement seen by the US. What kind of improvements was envisaged by those stakeholders?
It was mainly the fact that some of the disclosures were seeing a bit of an overload to entities that are private companies, so small entities. For those type of entities, it seems that the disclosures were perceived as onerous and maybe not appropriate or adequate.
And in terms of additions, and please bear in mind this is the exposure draft they have, and it is not, we do not know yet if this will be finalized and whether when finalized it will be in this shape or form, but additional disclosures they were proposing is to, back to your point, Peter, to separately disclose changes in unrealized gains or losses, not just for level 3, which is currently required, but also for the other levels. But preparers didn't like that at all. And also to provide some additional disclosures for level 3 fair value measurements, but this is really more making it consistent with IFRS requirements because they didn't have as much disclosures there to provide more about valuation inputs used in developing their estimate of significant unobservable inputs they were using in measurements.
Okay, thanks. The other question you asked is how do you perceive level 3 versus 2 versus 1? I think level 3 measurement is surrounded with more judgment, more uncertainty, but that is what it is. I mean, so to some extent, I can clearly understand why those assets are. Why you would want to look at them, okay, so this, how did you measure that? And I would expect that if you, as a preparer, provide sufficient narrative and explanation and on how you did your work, that actually can really add to the confidence in the numbers presented. So yes, it is more cumbersome, but it is a more complicated measurement anyway, so it's very logical. To my, it would be surprising that if it was the other way around.
Okay, Sue.
From what I understand from your staff, from the outreach that they've done so far, a lot of preparers have raised concerns and questions about the how burdensome the disclosure requirements are for level 3 assets and question the relevance of the information that might be provided that they're required to give on level 3, in particular the sensitivity analysis that they're required to provide. And I'd be particularly interested in whether anybody's got any thoughts in terms of whether the objective of providing the information that we've got is consistent with the information you actually need, and also in your experience, whether the information that's being provided is useful or not. And I guess what I really would appreciate any views on is the objective that we've set the wrong objective, or is the quality of what's provided not good? And trying to unpick those two things, because I think in theory it might be good to have sensitivity information about level 3 measurements, yes or no. And secondly, in practice, is the information being provided helpful to understand that if you think sensitivity analysis is important? Because unless we hear from investors that it is good information, we're going to have trouble balancing the preparer, to be blunt.
Okay. Now it's me, then Glenn, and then Robert. I just wanted to comment upon your question relating to the different levels. What I see back home, and to me, the level 1 bucket is like shares, bonds, normally rather small portion because there are very little trading in an industrial company, which is my main market, and also in the Swedish banks, the trading is very small, hardly, it's neglectable more or less. The bucket 2 becomes the bigger one because in the bucket 2 I find derivatives, related more or less to currencies, not all of it, but to some extent also related to interest rates. And to me, that is very close to the bucket one valuation, because the correlation between the value that you calculate and the movement in the underlying instrument is so easy to spot. So I think level two, from that perspective, my analysis becomes very easy to understand. The difference between level two and level three is precisely what you're aiming at. If you take a property company presenting in line with IAS 40, the market values of the real estate, they are on level three, all of them. Although you can point at a similar property on the other side of the street saying the value of that per square meter is the following, it's still a level three valuation because you use that input into a model. It's not a direct correlation, but you use it as one important but one of many inputs into a valuation. And those are the three main situations that I see, and I come across the level two and the level three valuation. And I definitely, to comment upon Sue, information relating to level three you cannot get enough of. And to take it the other way around, it's in the interest of the company to present that information, because I think everybody in this room are kind of hesitating to take that level three valuation into the income statement or into the valuation model without trying to figure out themselves if this is a valuation that I can sign on to, more or less. Okay.
There's some I just want to say there's some context around level two and level three, I think that's kind of helpful here, which is not directly related to fair value, which is that obviously we know that these bank balance sheets, I'm talking about IFRS 9 here or IFRS 39 here, have surprised people. That's the starting point. And because they've surprised people, people are scrutinizing them even more than they would otherwise have done, not just investors, but regulators and you know, just stewardship, basically, normal corporate governance of investment. The general principle that went through both IAS 39 and IFRS 9, I think it's a good one, which is that we should have everything at fair value where possible. And then we have this kind of big exception, which is where held to maturity can be held on a different basis, provided there are disclosures. The point about the disclosures is that when you see the level three, the exception is provided because there's a particular kind of business model that says, I'm holding this for a long period of time and I have the financial means to do so, and basically I intend, you know, there's a whole kind of setup that goes with that. What the level three does is to direct the investor back to the business model. And what it does is to force the investor and the company to have to defend all the aspects of the business model that allows you to go away from fair value. And I think that's really important. So the more you see the level three, and this is why it occurs in banks and not in property companies or other companies, because in other companies we're used to the idea that you hold property for, you know, it's basically a liquid asset, you're going to hold it for a long period of time, and therefore the business model that it's tied up with is very familiar to investors, that you buy and hold property for a long time and you're basically managing a yield, a dividend out of this thing. Whereas in the case of financial institutions, we're a little bit more suspicious about whether that's really the intention, because they can change their minds, and if they change their minds, you won't necessarily notice within the period, you know, in the period it takes to produce one set of financial results to the next, they change their minds and then suddenly the business model has changed. So the emphasis here becomes on producing the information. So just to give you what I think I'd expect to see as an investor here, is enough information to be able to test whether the business model that allows them to move away from fair value is the right one. And that is more stress than on disclosures about why they have moved away from that, so after maturity, etc. But also, and I think this is one of the areas where, you know, you need there needs to be some more backup on segmental accounting if a lot of it depends on understanding a business segment. So, for example, in the financial crisis, a lot of these held to maturity assets turned out to be subprime. And they were set, they were treated as in the segmental reporting as that's where you saw it. You saw it because you went to the segment. You wouldn't otherwise have seen it as a separate item. Now, clearly, I mean, in retrospect, there wasn't enough information to be able to form a sensible view on all these, and when they, you know, when three quarters of them went bust, in fact, they all went bust, I don't think that anybody was kind of fully aware of that. Not even the banks that owned them, to be honest, about what was going on there. And I think that, and that's a question of business model. I think everybody knew that the assets were kind of soft, etc. What we weren't completely sure about, and I don't think the banks were completely sure about either, was that the business model itself would allow them to hold these assets to term. Because the investors themselves, you know, the lenders themselves were the ones that were bailing out. And they had no ability to hold, and that was the gap. The gap was that, you know, jingle mail, the people just basically handed the keys and said, well, enough with this thing, collapsed the business model around that. That kind of information. So I always thought, just to go back to, sorry to go on a bit about this, but I always thought, if you read the old IS-39, or the current IS-39, it always said that where you had embedded options, you had to kind of strip them out, and if you couldn't strip them out, you valued the whole security at market. But what it didn't say, and I think this was the weakness in that model, and maybe still, and I think to some extent has been captured by the new fair value disclosures, is that when a bank takes collateral over an asset, it's obviously got an option over the asset. So you've got the basic loan and the loan made to the lender. But then you've got the collateral that's taken over the property. But what's not often realized is that if you're a subprime lender, subprime borrower, you too have an option. And it's a real option. It's the option to put back to the financial institution. And that too has a value which needs to be taken into account when you're assessing the value of the loan instrument. So in the financial crisis, what we discovered, I'm not blaming anyone for this because we only discovered this in retrospect, it was that option that was held by the investor to put back to the financial institution that rose in value. And it was that reason that the securities started to collapse in value. And if you had kind of looked at IS-39 in a fundamental sense, in a kind of, you know, slightly ideological way, you would have said that there were embedded options that had to be valued in fair value. And therefore, because that's what the market was doing. The market was simply saying, okay, the value of the put held by the investor is a kind of real option that can be valued by reference to house prices. And if you do your Black-Scholes model on that, you will come to a number which gives you a discount against. So the level three is meant to capture all of that. And all I'm saying to you is that if you have enough information, which we don't right now, but if you had enough information to be able to capture that, then you have enough information to form an assessment. But if you don't have enough information to capture that part of the thing, then basically you're lacking what you need to be able to understand what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, thank you so much for that. It's very interesting. And Peter Clark is not here. I mean, sometimes we indulge in discussions about real options. And, I mean, clearly they're not accounted for in any way in IFRS standards, and there are many ways you can see that they are relevant and how that could be useful information. But to Michael's relief, that's not the... something we're going to be really addressing as a part of this project.
I wouldn't want to get into the detail, but I mean, there are requirements in 39 and 9 about taking, what's in 39 about taking out embedded derivatives on that.
Correct. Yeah. But just to maybe point where you said level 3 disclosure for items measured at cost, right, is something that is useful for you to test the business model. And just to draw you back to the slide 8 with disclosure requirements, actually the disclosures for items measured at cost, when fair value amounts have to be recognized, are not that onerous, and there is really not much disclosures for level 3 required apart from asking companies to disclose what level that is. Where the requirements for level 3 come in place is when you have something that is measured at fair value in the balance sheet, and then you have to disclose you know, valuation inputs and so on. So are you saying that...
No, my point is simply this, is that it's the way you have large level three, so judgmental valuation items, you need to go back and take a look at the disclosures on the business model that allows...
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's all I'm saying. So I gave you one, two examples there. One was about the real real options, and one was about subsidiaries, the subprime subsidiaries holding, because they weren't allowed to finance them on balance sheet, right? Because the regulators had stopped that. So that wasn't completely disclosed. We only discovered this kind of in retrospectively, that you couldn't finance what effectively were consumer finance companies, even though they were owned by the bank through intercompany finance.
Okay. Thank you for that.
Okay. Next one, Robert.
So I'm going to try and help directly to Sue's question, and I'm going to try and pull the, there are a lot of threads. I'm going to try and pull them together. I'm going to start with a little piece of information. 20 years ago, my job was to calculate something that was fairly close to fair value for mines, and for the purpose of calculating actually how much money we would lend to them. So the interesting thing is, by the way, you can, anybody who's thinking extractive industries, fair value was easy to do. I can tell you how to do it, and there was an answer. And that explanation and that answer was not developed by me. It was actually developed by a CFA committee 20 years ago, who were challenged to say, if you were going to do fair value, and these were actually people that would generate the numbers. A lot of them were real oil and gas people. They said, if you had to generate fair value numbers, how would you do it, and how would you stop the gaming? And gaming is in two pieces. There's actual gaming, but there's also just management's perception. Your boss says, give me the most optimistic number. There's also, part that I'm going to talk about auditors. Auditors have no idea what the right number is. In fact, what you want on fair value for mining, I'm going to draw analogies to the finance, is you actually want the person who's in the trenches' best guess. And how do you extract that best guess? The way to do it, we found, was put down the assumptions. And so the assumption is, what is your assumption about recovery rates? What is your assumption about costs? Now let's do it for financial instruments. What is the underlying assumptions that are buried into the model? So ideally what you want to do is, for all of these instruments, is you would provide people with these were the key assumptions we picked last time. These are the changes and assumptions that we decided to make, and these were the dollar income, the dollar impact, and this is the change in fair value. A reconciliation from here to there. And for a mining or oil company, it's fairly easy to do. It's, what was the change in ore reserves? How much did you, add? How much did you subtract? What are the assumptions? You know, it's doable, and it works out to being about 10 things for a mine. And you can do it for an oil field. You could do it for, you probably could do it even for a country, Nigeria. The problem you get, and I keep bringing back to financial instruments, the problem you do is you cannot do this, because it's a product by product. You can't do this for a bank. Banks have enough products that you'd have pages and pages of this particular instrument, here are my assumptions, this particular instrument, I have that assumptions. So then what do? And the answer is, you have no choice but to use the imperfect tool of sensitivity. Because you need to translate risk. You need to the sensitivity at least highlights people to the risk exposure. It doesn't keep the analysts honest, or the issuer honest. And the example I'm going to use very specifically is, think of a poor geologist who says, I've changed my recovery assumptions. The CFO gets mad. You know, the first time the CFO said, give me the best number you can, and then it gets changed 3 years in a row. Finally, the CFO says, just give me your best guess, because I'm tired of explaining the ups and downs. And so the industry would move to best guess pretty quickly. So sensitivity doesn't address that. It doesn't address the gaming, but it at least highlights people to the exposures. I would have loved, I couldn't even follow all the threads that Glenn was throwing out. And it's unfortunate. I couldn't catch all of them, and I won't even start to talk about some of them. But you did hit on one of them. A good sensitivity analysis should the company needs to be granular enough to actually capture some of these options, some of these things that there will be in some of these markets tipping points where all of a sudden nothing works, and a good sensitivity analysis should capture those. That's an ideal world, because I think correctly, I think the banks failed to recognize that they couldn't capture all of them. But so, in summary, actually, not surprisingly, you need a lot more information level three, not less. And to anybody that says, I don't want to do sensitivities, the answer is straight in the faces. Sensitivities is a concession to the preparers to make your life a lot easier. The alternative is to just give us all the options by portfolio, by type of product.
Robert, if I may follow up with you, and you can do this offline or after the meeting, if you have a good example of sensitivity analysis that you have seen in practice, and this question maybe goes for all of you, because what we have been hearing so far in outreach is auditors, preparers saying, I have not seen a good sensitivity analysis in my professional career yet, and therefore, you know, what's the point of just having this? If this goes by 5%, you know, this is what we do, but nothing ever goes by 5%. There's so many complexity linkages between the things, and, you know, the information is not deemed to be useful in any way. And I don't know, maybe what you're saying is just the process of going through the exercise in itself, making them do that. But, you know, any examples that, going back to Sue's point, to help us say this is actually doable, you can do it if you really want to.
In the interest of time, I think we probably had an offline conversation. I could have a copy of it. I will make one comment, though. You used one word in there that you should not use, and that two words that should never be close together, sensitivity and auditors. Auditors are, for at least two or three reasons, are the wrong people to be in the room. They are not interested in, they're not financial analysts. They have, their business model is about, is different than the preparers and the users. And they are incapable of doing the one thing that users really need, which is pick a number. An auditor cannot say 5% interest rate is a good assumption for next year. They are genetically incapable of doing what we do every day.
I think apart from the difficulties in the analysis, in the sensitivity analysis, I think one added complexity here that these preparers have mentioned to us is how to aggregate this information that is meaningful for you, especially in banks when they have thousands of products and basically many, many, many level three instruments. How can they present the sensitivity analysis in a way that can be useful for you? That is their challenge, actually, as well.
Do you want me to?
Yeah. If you have seen anything that is also good for us to look at.
I am slightly sympathetic to the bank's problem because my experience, and I actually do have experience with some of these complicated products, and it's, you can't use the mining example or the by the way, the mining example is exactly the same thing for buildings. It's the same methodology, and it works on an asset financing. The problem the banks are facing is that when you aggregate a whole bunch of portfolios, they're going to move in a different. So I'm thinking product is grouped in portfolios, and portfolios are aggregated into bank-wide positions. The problem is that they aggregate everything. You've lost all the information. If we ask them to disaggregate it too much, then it becomes a telephone book. The only constructive comment I can make is that, goes back to my earlier comment about the geologists, the only people that have a chance of being able to get this right are the risk management people at the bank. Without too much of, and without too much filtering from the auditors. And this is really a case to Paul about where we really do need, this really is a case where it is different in every organization. And this is where that we would expect a lack of consistency Because and legitimately the sensitivities might be different for different types of banks because they're different in different markets and they've got different types of products. And so one bank might say a 1% movement is not going to affect us because, and another would say it's going to affect us madly. And they could also say we're dealing with different markets, therefore the possible credit spreads might be different. This is a place where they are different. And I think the only constructive comment I would say is get the auditors out of the room. Go find the operating people, the risk management people in your organization, and ask them to try and this is a case where management's own information would be useful. I will give one final comment. I sat with a senior risk person a number of years ago at Bank of Nova Scotia on a specific project. We were talking about value at risk, and he said he was running something like 30 value at risk models. And I looked at him and he said, "You've got to be kidding." And I said, "Why?" He says, "Because each one of them gives us slightly different information." Imagine that world where you're running all sorts of different models on the same portfolio because it's showing you different stuff.
But that's the reality of life, isn't it? And I was going to attempt to answer Sue's question as well, and I think I'm going to end up agreeing with Robert and also disagreeing with Robert, which is fun today. What's the problem with level three? Well, it's all models, and we don't really trust the models. In fact, we've learned not to trust the models, and life is complicated, and the only way that you can actually understand it is to look at it from 20 different angles, and you might then have some sort of understanding. We don't trust the models, so sensitivity analysis is really, really important because it's giving us some sort of insight into how close to the edge that particular institution is pushing things. And so, you know, it's vital for us to get a feel for how many different angles we need to be looking at. The banks will be doing this sensitivity analysis anyway. The challenge is not the doing of the analysis, it's how that then gets translated into the disclosures, as you say, and that is a challenge. The space where I'm going to disagree with Robert is the auditor space. I agree we don't want the auditors to be doing this stuff, but we need the auditors to be looking at this stuff. Mm-hmm.
Agreed.
And the fact that there is a requirement to have sensitivity disclosures gives the auditors something to bite on in this space and to challenge the management about whether they are pushing their models too close to the boundaries and whether actually the numbers that they are putting on these things aren't sustainable because actually they're too close to the edge.
I'd like to clarify the auditor comment. The auditors are absolutely integral to the process because they force the sort of the analysis. What the auditor can do is they can say, given these set of assumptions, this is correct, and we've looked at it. What the auditor cannot do is say whether the assumption is 5 or 6. The only people that can do that are people who are in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. So that was the piece I wanted to clarify.
I just wanted to comment upon your remark that what if a bank has a bunch of level 3 valuations presented in the balance sheet, how can they kind of disclose each and every one of them? My view is that if I find the bank with a bunch of level 3 valuations, I will be quite scared. Because to me, they normally deal with 1 and 2, actually. And in that case, I will also say that all this separation into 1, 2, and 3 gives me information that I couldn't get previously. Mm-hmm. So if the alternative is to scrap level 3 and just say you can only value according to 1 and 2, that's much worse than to have level 3 with its uncertainties, mm-hmm. but maybe a starting point for asking the company questions or the bank questions. To me, I'm this kind of screening equity analyst that do that, not so much digging into a company.
I mean, I'm not so interested, as obviously Robert is, to get into the loan book and separate everything and try to find the smoking gun somewhere. But to me, I think that this separation into different levels is helpful, definitely. Osman.
So I wonder if there's worth thinking about if there's a difference between sensitivity analysis and this concept of valuation uncertainty. Because I look at, when I think about what a bank's fair value financial assets, financial liabilities, the number on the balance sheet, there's some sensitivity analysis around that. I think what we try and explore in our meetings with issuers is you've got a single number in the balance sheet for this type of portfolio of assets or liabilities. Where in the range, what's the range? Is it here or is it here? And where are you within that range? Are you here or are you here? Now, you raised the comment which kind of reminded me of this idea. Is, you know, have you seen, I think something along that, have you seen good examples or can banks provide sensitive analysis that are more meaningful? Actually, they, with this regard, this valuations uncertainty, many banks already do, but not to the public, not to us, to their regulators. So you have this concept of prudent valuation in the regulatory terms that banks, certainly in the UK and I think now in the European Union as well, provide to their regulator, which kind of gives you a breakdown of the fair valued assets, the more exotic ones, applies, and I'm afraid I don't know the detail, but we can certainly dig out the forms and the instructions that come with the forms to say, you know, take this and apply this VAR adjustments, this 99% one-day confidence interval, and that gives you an upside and a downside, and it's not a, you know, a detailed, the ones that I've seen in blank forms are not hugely detailed, they're a couple of pages long, and covers quite a lot of portfolio. So there is maybe some merit in exploring that idea for disclosure, to talk about valuation uncertainty and the ranges rather than just the sensitivities.
Yeah, I think that was the intention in IFRS 13, but you're quite right that it probably gets the loss of translation applied.
Okay, then, Marietta.
Yeah, I think I have a slightly similar comment to Osman, just a very, very general comment on sensitivities in all walks of life. I think sensitivity analyses are very important, but it's also very important that they really also show you what would happen under extreme stress. Because one thing that I've noticed quite a lot with companies is that they give you all sorts of routine disclosures, and I'm not a banks analyst, I look at industrials, I pharmaceutical companies. They give you sort of the sensitivity of their results and their asset values and so forth to, let's say, a 1% movement in a certain currency against the dollar or you know, a 10 bips interest rate change. But basically, you can't just, you know, if you assume that there's going to be a 20% movement, you can't just multiply that number by 20. Because under extreme stress, all of the correlations that these assumptions are based on are going to break down. And so I think, you know, if you're going to be asking for sensitivity analyses, it's always really important to also then give people a feel for what would really happen if we get extreme movements in interest rates, currencies, other factors. And maybe the best way to do that is actually in the context of some sort of a valuation uncertainty discussion. But it's just very misleading if you get some sort of a sensitivity and you think you can just multiply that through with whatever your assumptions about potential changes in the underlying assumptions are.
Yeah, I mean, the text that is used in IFRS 13 is sensitivity that reflects reasonably possible alternatives or changes in inputs. And I think that was a good intention, and it wasn't around extreme, but it was around. But I think Sue is
I was just going to respond to that because it's actually an interesting point because I've thought about it more along the lines of what I think Osman was getting at, which was we know that at the balance sheet date for the level three numbers, you had to pick a number if you like because you can only report one number. But we know when they picked that number, they had to think about a range of possible outcomes based on the situation as at the reporting date. It's not just there is one number, you had to think about a range and ultimately you had to choose where you were in that range, right? So if I think about valuation uncertainty, that's giving me colour about, okay, you picked this, but given the choices you had, it could have been there and it could have been there, and is that narrow or that wide? Which is slightly different to saying, if I had a really different scenario, how vulnerable would the values of this particular portfolio be? You know, I think today, you know, the situation is quite good, and therefore this is my valuation. But if the situation was I had a massive downturn stress scenario, how much would the valuation change? That's a different exam question, if you like, to saying, given the conditions at this date, what range was I choosing for? And I think 13's getting more at what you're trying to get at, rather than what Marietta's talking about.
Goro. Okay. I think that this is an area that the probably the ISB cannot, you know, determine that what is the right disclosure by yourself. You know, that the, you know, banks are, you know, basically regulated industry, and the Basel Committee, you know, the requiring banks to disclose, you know, more detailed or granular disclosure based on so-called peer-to-peer disclosure requirements. And the, in many cases, I believe that the Osman is more, you know, familiar with them myself, because I'm an ex-banker, banking analyst. I'm not following the banks very closely. But the when I was on the banking analyst, you know, that the all these regulatory disclosure tend to give you know, better picture on this kind of you know, information. And the one of the difficult thing for you is the, you know, the anyway, all these disclosures are based on the, you know, accounting rules, rather than the, you know, kind of risk management practice, which Robert suggests. So that the, anyway, I don't think that the all these accounting disclosure requirements would give you give us you know, the you know, very exact pictures of the economic reality of banks. So that, but the still, you can cooperate with the Basel Committee. What would be the, you know, better disclosure on this?
Okay, Peter, finally.
Okay, I just want to echo a couple of things that I've heard. If we step back and think of like information economics, there is a difference between risk and uncertainty. And so some of the highlights that have been brought up by Osman and also by Sue and all, when we developed our research platform at the firm where I used to work, we tried to sort of tell the analysts that there was thinking about uncertainty that was important in doing their job. And a sensitivity analysis does not help you think about uncertainty, because you assume a distribution, you assume certain parameters are known, and you just vary them along something that you know already. And that doesn't always give you the answers that you want. You do indeed have to think about combining a number of the underlying factors in scenarios, for example, to gauge what uncertainties you're facing. And so I think pushing towards sensitivity analysis, or saying that's enough to sort of deal with this, is probably not enough. It's about having people take the responsibility to combine certain factors together and give you a sense of what the uncertainty is that they face. So it's about combining some of the underlying factors rather than just assume, I'll give you a couple of distributional outcomes along different variables. That doesn't really get to the point of uncertainty.
Okay. You have something more to
add? I'm just conscious of the time, and I'm looking at friends and Peter yourself. I mean, do you want us to sum up the meeting, or I mean, there are two other questions we haven't covered on the any adjustments you made to fair value and any inconsistency you've noticed, and I don't know how many of you have specific input to these. I mean, we have already received a lot from the session, but do guide us as to whether we can continue.
I can answer from my perspective, and normally I look at industrial companies, not banks, non-banks companies. And then of course the normal fair value adjustment I do is like if they have interest rate derivatives, that goes up and down tremendously that I don't want to have included in my kind of ongoing analysis. I can have currency-related derivatives that I want to strip out because the volatility is not what I want, at least not at that time, for example. When I come to banks...
So you strip it out rather than put in your own number?
No, I strip it out because it's financial, and the financial part in an industrial company I take care of later, so I get it as a financial asset or a financial liability instead. When it comes to banks, nothing is stripped out because you really don't know what to strip out when it comes to fair value. And you really don't know. I can take the items that I can see in OCI in the bank, but what I know is it's not all the fair value revaluations that I see in the OCI. So if I kind of put that in, or so it becomes like an arbitrary adjustment only. So in the banks, I try to look at the kind of trading net, although it's not the trading net, true trading net, and try to spot whether the volatility or the ongoing trend in the trading net is something that I can put into my analysis, but I don't do any adjustments on it because I cannot really explain what I have adjusted, actually. Anyone else adjusting for financial instruments?
Well, does anyone adjust the actual fair value numbers? I think that was,
yeah, that was the question.
Okay, so yeah, fair value numbers, okay. No, that I don't do at all.
Well, I gave you the example. I always do for what I know are the real, because I think that's the only way you do it. Because remember what we're trying to do. We're trying to work out what the economic reality is, and we're trying to map the accounting that captures the economic reality. And where the economic reality includes these very difficult concepts of one person's right to say no and another person's right to say yes, etc., we have to map all of that. So I don't think that when we're talking about fair value, we can really ignore embedded options. I think they're intrinsic to the evaluation of the subject. I think absolutely core, because if you strip them out, you've lost touch with the economic reality. That's the
option. In theory, if a bank had a portfolio of, I don't know, mortgages, and they were in a situation where somebody, their portfolio people were likely to walk away and leave the keys in the letterbox, if they were doing their fair values properly in their disclosures, you would hope that the value of the loans would reflect that, right?
Yeah.
And so you'd basically be saying, okay, that's a more relevant number than the amortized cost number now because of that option.
Yeah, right? Exactly. I think there's a simpler way of approaching this, which is that the general principle is that everything's a fair value. That's the general principle, subject to, and then there's a whole series of exceptions. So this whole issue about where you have financial instruments on a bank that is not at fair value is one of those exceptions, and those exceptions are allowed if you meet certain tests. And those tests are basically about a business model. You have a business model that supports the use of those tests. And the disclosures about that business model are what went wrong the last time. It wasn't that we weren't kind of capturing all that value. It was because the banks weren't able. Because what, you know, the old idea was, held to maturity means that if you had the resources to do it and you intended to do it, you could hold it at amortized cost. That was the old principle, right? But what we didn't take into account is that it's not just the decision of the bank. That was the third leg of the economic reality that was not in the standard. That's the point I'm making. That the standard didn't have all the elements that made the business model sustainable.
And this is where it's interesting, and if Peter just allows me, because Glenn has mentioned our real options for two times, and I really have to say something. So it's very interesting making contrast with non-financial assets, because in fair value non-financial assets, we apply the concept of highest and best use, which means that no matter what you're using that asset for presently, in determining the fair value, you look at what is the highest and best use that you can have for that asset, and this is the basis on which the value. And normally you would expect these to be consistent because, you know, people are expected to behave rationally and do what's the best for that. But you do have cases when there are differences, and then people argue that that information is not useful because that value doesn't really correspond, and sometimes you have a problem with disaggregating. And this is an example where I think also real options would help, because instead of just capturing this one value, highest and best use, you can have your current use, And you can have a real option, which is a value of converting into this highest and best use. And the sum will still be that fair value, but that perhaps will then, you know, better disaggregate or show people what's going on.
So Peter and Marietta made the point. So this is a stress issue, that the values change depending on the circumstance. And I think this is a stress issue. I think all that needs to... one of the useful things about these accounting standards is that they're forcing some governance changes through as well. They're forcing banks to think carefully about what it is they're doing and how they're managing. And I think this is one of those areas where you don't need to tell everybody that they need to calculate a number, because everyone will go mad and they'll all end up with different numbers anyway. But they need to think about what that business model is that makes it sustainable. And once they think about that, they will have to have some way of capturing the information that, you know, may give them lots of different numbers, but will think about that. And the mere disclosure that there is an item there that needs to be thought about gives everybody else a chance to think about what that number is. And I think it's not the governance driving the standard, that's the standard driving the governance.
And the final comment comes from Mitch.
So the balance sheet is a snapshot of the financial condition of a business at any specific point in time. My concern is that in periods of volatility, you actually are misrepresenting the economic reality of a business. That, you know, being too specific, for example, on derivatives, can imply that things are much worse than they are, and then a quarter later, everything's fine. So I think you have to be a bit careful on the volatility. I would say also to your point, Glenn, about disclosure, certainly disclosure was a big issue in previous financial crises, even now. But I also think it's, you know, and this is where principles based becomes important. It's just the approach that financial manager or risk managers, whatever, took and how they value these level three assets. You know, if you look at the Italian banks right now, I mean, there's a morass of dead wood on balance sheets across banks in Europe. They're disclosing it, what they think the value is, but, you know, I think the issue is, you know, there needs to be some sort of responsibility that you're actually doing, you're being honest with yourselves, and when we know you're not. And that's it.
Okay.
Because if I can just say what we are taking away from this session, and it is really, I mean, what I've heard, Michael and Mariella, please add, is that you are quite pleased with the information provided by Fair Value Measurement, and really, in the disclosure area, there was none of these examples we mentioned as things that you feel were not useful, but can be done better, is really, and specifically to discuss level two versus level three, and sensitivity analysis disclosure. And this message is so helpful for us in taking back to our discussions with other stakeholders to kind of counteract quite different things we're hearing there. So thank you very much.
Thank you.